This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, July 26th. This is our local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we will be hearing from Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light, CAI's Eve Zuckoff. We'll check in with Sam Houghton at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood, the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Molly Reinman at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. CAI's Patrick Flannery speaks with our State House reporter Katie Lennon, and we'll hear from Marilee Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. More information has come out about the failed wind turbine blade on Vineyard Wind's offshore site, about 15 miles south of Nantucket. We're going to catch you up on all the latest. But first, here's how we got here. On Saturday, July 13th, a blade broke on an offshore wind turbine, apparently while it was going through some power-up testing. It hung on like a broken wing for several days, during which time it shed a lot of debris that has washed up in a number of locations, including on Nantucket. And then, toward the end of last week, it came off completely, falling into the ocean. We're talking about a blade that, intact, is longer than a football field and weighs more than 50 tons. Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light has been following this story closely, and she joins us now. Hi, Anastasia.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
There is a lot to talk about here. Let's start with the little bit that we learned about why the blade might have failed. The blade is actually manufactured by a company not Vineyard Wind. Tell us who this is.
That's right. So GE Vernova, part of General Electric, is the manufacturer for the blades that Vineyard Wind is using. It's one of the few major manufacturers for wind turbines. The others would be Siemens Gamesa, which is being used in other projects in the Northeast, and Vestas. But it's this manufacturer and components that were manufactured in Canada that may have some issues.
Now, the information that came out about what may have happened with the blade actually came out on earnings call that GE Vernova, this company, was doing this week. It was kind of a public quarterly call with investors. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep. So GE Vernova's CEO announced that they believe, based on their initial, investigation, that this is a manufacturing defect. They're very emphatic that they don't believe this is some engineering or design flaw, which could be potentially more serious. They think it's isolated to just how this blade was manufactured, and specifically they cited insufficient bonding, so whatever materials used to bond the different components in a blade as being at issue here. And again, this is their initial findings. They've not completed what they call this root cause analysis to more conclusively determine, this is what happened here before they can move forward with the project.
So as you say, this blade was produced in a factory in Canada, and they say that they produced about 150 of these blades at this factory in Canada. So they're stopping everything and they're going to go back and inspect these, which I think initially a lot of us heard that and you're thinking about them crawling over or taking off blades and somehow testing them. But they're going to do something different. We don't know a whole lot, but kind of what they're pointing towards.
Yeah, I sort of had the same idea in my head when I heard that, there are a bunch of blades in New Bedford now. So I was wondering if they'd be climbing up on those stacked at the terminal as well. But as GE officials explained, this is actually more of a looking at, photos and data that's already been gathered for these blades. It's the way it sounds is when they're in the factory, they all get scanned. They explained it as sort of a non-invasive technique. So they're really just going to be looking at scans and photographs that have already been taken, and they use, medical scans as an analogy, like an MRI or something, to just really scrutinize those images again. And they wouldn't give a timeline on to how long that would take. They emphasize that they want to be very thorough. They recognize haste is sort of important. We all want answers, but they're really emphasizing they want to be very thorough in looking at this. And, of course, they have to get through this before the Vineyard Wind project can get back online and send power and continue construction. That's all been brought to a halt by federal agencies until, you know, GE and Vineyard Wind can determine what went wrong and, you know, rule out any other turbines that could be affected.
Now, these specific blades are they're front edge technology. They're so massive, and they're being produced in Canada. They're also being produced in Europe and being used in Europe on one site. And there was some question about whether whatever happened here would impact what, you know, the offshore wind turbine that's being put together right now off Europe. I think it's called Dogger's Bank. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that they seem to think that this is two separate issues, and what's happening here is not going to impact what's happening in Europe. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct. So with the Dogger Bank wind farm in the UK, there was a blade failure there. Also, the same model, this Haliade X model. And the way they explain it, what happened there is it was the result of an installation issue. Of course, these are very big pieces that have to get lifted and put onto the turbine that's built at sea. And so people were wondering, maybe did this happen here? There are lots of steps for turbines getting installed in the U.S. because, you know, there's the Jones Act, which precludes using certain vessels. So there's lots of stopping and going and moving these parts from one boat to the other. But the way they explained it is that, no, this is separate. They believe this is disconnected. This isn't an installation issue. This is likely due to a manufacturing error that happened at the factory.
I want to talk a little bit about concerns about health risks from the debris. A preliminary environmental analysis has been released. Tell us a little bit about this report.
Yep. So it was a fairly brief report. The main takeaway is that they believe the real only risk injury for people is when they come into physical contact with these blades. They're comprised of foam, fiberglass shards. So really the idea that you can maybe get cut or something or hurt when physically handling it. That's why the companies are saying they don't want people, the public, to handle it, just to notify them and they can have their crews come gather it. They also determine that these materials are inert, that they're non-toxic. But I will say many in the public were not satisfied with that report. They still have concerns. They still feel it's lacking in addressing, you know, what impacts this could have to marine life and marine life that might be ingesting, you know, these pieces and then eventually, you know, humans eating this, shellfish, what have you. So in a meeting in Nantucket this week, there were still a lot of questions the public had, and it was emphasized that this is just an initial analysis. They'll be looking more into, you know, marine life impacts and so on. But they really just established initially that they believe that there's their only really physical threat at this time, and that it's non-toxic to people.
What do we know about what's happening at the site right now offshore there where this blade fell into the water?
Yep, so it's hard to know, right? This is very far offshore. They have a safety zone set up. But what we do know from GE CEO and other officials, they shared this, is that earlier this week, they actually were remotely able to rotate the turbine 7 to 10 degrees, and they're doing this to see if any more debris shakes loose. There is, you know, parts of that blade that are still attached to the turbine. There is a big piece that fell off, that 300-foot piece that is now on the ocean bottom that they're working on retrieving. But so they're going to keep doing that. I don't know till when. And then eventually they would have to send in people and crews to try and remove that safely. And they haven't provided much detail on that so far. They are working under the supervision of, you know, federal agencies and also state agencies to make sure that this is done safely. But yeah, still lots of questions, unanswered questions on that front of, you know, next steps and how soon those will happen.
Anastasia, I'm curious, you're on the ground there in New Bedford. As you say, there are blades stacked there that have not been installed yet, you know, getting ready to go out to the wind farm. Have you seen any impacts on the operations on the ground there? Is there a sense that everything is just on hold, or is it just as busy as ever?
Yeah, so I mean, I've driven by a few times since. It's hard to see, you know, along the quayside where boats are getting docked. You can still see a lot of the site, however. So there are people moving around. There are cranes operating. So there is work happening. But, you know, Port Authority here, who they're constantly in talk with the project and for all the vessels coming in, the way they explained it is we will likely see components continue to come into the port. They said the supply kind of went down, so there's lots of room for more turbine components to come in. But what will happen is that they're probably not going to be going out until the suspension from the federal government gets lifted, because, of course, Vineyard Wind cannot continue with installation of these wind turbine generators until, you know, they're in the clear. So what we might see is just more components continue to come in, but no barge movements in the near future of you know, these components, these stacked blades heading out to the site.
It's Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Anastasia, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
And a little later in the program, we will be checking in with Jason Graziadei at Nantucket Current to hear about the view of this situation now on the ground on Nantucket. Once again, the Massachusetts Army National Guard is seeking bids from contractors to build a machine gun range at Joint Base Cape Cod, though the controversial project is still awaiting approval. CAI's Eve Zuckoff is here to talk about what the Guard may be hoping for. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Tell us what you know about this latest request for bids by the Guard.
Sure. So the Guard's ad, which ran in the Cape Cod Times last Friday and was sent to me by three listeners, actually, calls for a contractor that can build a range with three shooting lanes, and they specify 800-meter-long lanes. We'll get back to why that's important later. Additional infrastructure would also be needed, they say in this ad, including a range control tower, an ammunition breakdown building, covered mess, classroom, and storage. And all of this, the Guard estimates in the ad, it's fairly short, would cost around $8.9 million to build, and they are taking bids until August 7th.
And you have kind of a screenshot of the ad on our website, so you can actually look at see what they're asking for.
Yes.
Earlier plans called for an 8-lane range. Now they're calling for 3 lanes at just, 800 meters or something like that?
That's
so,
right.
Yeah. So what changed?
Yeah, well, the money's changed. In 2023, the Guard placed their first ad seeking bidders in the Cape Cod Times, and we learned after an APCC records request, Association to Preserve Cape Cod, that two contractors submitted bids that each estimated the project would cost around $15 million, but that's significantly more money than the Guard had at the time, more than the $9.7 million that Congress had appropriated for the range. And now that $9.7 million is set to expire in September after Representative Bill Keating and Senator Elizabeth Warren successfully fought against a funding extension. And now the Guard is kind of left with this scenario where they're like, okay, our money is running out. What if instead of building a much bigger range with 8 lanes that are 1,500 meters in length, we go for a 3-lane range that are 800 meters, and it seems like they're looking to do something, but we have not gotten comment. I asked them a bunch of questions via email and didn't get an answer.
So for folks who have not been following this years-long saga, everything's hanging up a little bit while a report that pointed towards concerns about this range possibly impacting the aquifer and compromising the water source essentially for much of the Upper Cape is holding this up, and the report is only in draft form. Could the Guard get approval by September when you say all this money is going to due to run out?
It's unlikely. I mean, state officials who have the power to approve or deny the project have said they are waiting for this report that you're describing from the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, we don't have a timeline for when that will be finalized. We asked just a couple months ago. So this is actually where we have started to hear pushback from groups, again, like APCC, who say, look, the Guard shouldn't be going for this scaled down range now. This is kind of in bad faith. And we, again, haven't gotten a comment from the Guard to get their point of view.
We asked, but we did ask.
Yes, we ask every time.
Okay. Switching gears here, I want to ask you about a story that you did this week on hurricane preparedness. You talked to emergency planners and meteorologists. How do they think about the worst case scenario storm for Cape Cod?
You know, I loved this question because everyone I've talked to has given me a different scary scenario. When I asked Cape Cod meteorologist Phil Burt, he described a worst case scenario storm that combines the power of the 1938 New England hurricane, where sections of Falmouth and New Bedford were 8 feet underwater, on the path of Hurricane Bob in 1991, so kind of smushing them together. But when I asked Barnstable County's Emergency Preparedness Director Chip Riley, his answer was much less about geography. It's much more about timing. He said it's any major storm, Category 3, because we don't really get 4 and 5 5, they get ripped apart when they reach up here, hitting on a Saturday in August. That is what keeps them up at night.
Because Saturday is changeover day.
You That's changeover day.
People leaving, people arriving.
Ugh, yes. Our roads are so clogged. We've got millions of people here. That would be such a mess.
Okay. And just for folks who are wondering why we're maybe pointing at this, the NOAA, the Atmospheric Administration, has suggested that this could be the busiest hurricane season in a long time.
Yeah, up to 25 named storms are predicted.
What did these emergency planners tell you about what our on-the-ground plans are if a hurricane does hit?
Well, so emergency planners described, first of all, to me, an evacuation plan. So for those in low-lying areas and for more vulnerable people, especially if we have pretty good advanced warning, which we should, that a major hurricane is coming up this way, the goal is to get people evacuated at least 12 hours before hurricane force winds begin. The worst-case scenario, according to the state, is that it may take up to 34 hours for all evacuating drivers to leave Cape Cod. And I said to Chip Riley, so if I'm driving back from Provincetown on one of these evacuation days, could I sit in traffic for 18 hours? And he said, oh, yeah, sure. So that is still, though, kind of the best case scenario, that you get all those people off. The scary thing is that if wind speeds reach 75 miles per hour, often the bridges will be shut down. There's concerns about cars rolling over. And then if you shut down those lanes, we're really in a mess. And so if there are a bunch of people on the road who aren't able to get off, then they will be diverted into emergency shelters. The Joint Base Cape Cod would be opened up. And we all just kind of pray for that not to happen. Mm. So they say, for the most part, they've coined this term yo-yo 72. Most people on the Cape in the case of a storm would be on their own for the first 72 hours of the storm. So they say that's why you need the flashlights, the food, the water, the cash, the extra stash of gas, etc.
Okay, I know you're going to bring us one more hurricane story next week, all about hurricanes, how they affect the, you know, what would happen to the impacts on real estate, I guess, and in communities here if one strikes. But one more story before I let you go. I have just about a minute here. You're reporting a North Atlantic right whale was seen off the coast of Ireland. These are our North Atlantic right whales that we see off the coast of Cape Cod all the time. For the first time in 114 years, these are endangered animals. Tell us about the details of this sighting.
Yeah, so we got this information from the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, not a group that has ever waded into the North Atlantic right whale story that I'm aware of in the past. And this sighting was exceptionally rare for the Eastern Atlantic. Again, we're talking about North Atlantic right whales. And I mean, these critically endangered whales have been absent from the Irish coast for decades, if not longer. Though it is a little bit hard to know, you know, if one was there and one just wasn't sighted. We don't tag these animals, so we don't know where all of them are. But it was verified by the New England Aquarium, which curates the North Atlantic right whale photo ID catalog. And then meanwhile, there were a ton of other whales kind of, you know, in scattered places across the East Coast. I have the North Atlantic right whale map up if you'd like to know where they are now.
Where are they?
Okay. We've got a bunch up in Canada, in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And there are a bunch for folks kind of heading down this way off the coast of New York, south of the Rhode Island Sound. There are a ton of sightings. So again, off the coast of Ireland could not be more head-scratching.
And just about 350 of these whales left, they think?
That's right. That's right. They're critically endangered, the most endangered whale species in the world. So we know climate change has moved them to different places, and knowing where they are is really important because it allows, you know, for the right management picture to happen. So this Irish whale drinking a pint over there, again, is just posing so many problems.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Tensions can run high in summer. Things are busy. Accidents can happen. In Edgartown Harbor, a large and expensive yacht struck a small and somewhat scruffy commercial fishing boat. The incident has developed into a bit of a legal contention. Sam Houghton of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us to explain. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
The names of the boats and the names of the people involved here are all somewhat colorful, you could say. Maybe you can start by telling us who's involved and how this came about.
Yeah, what I would say one of my favorite headlines of the year, for us at least, the Ruffian and the Payback is what we called it. The Ruffian being this big yacht and the Payback being this smaller boat. But right, as kind of our video and that we obtained and some of our reporting showed, this boat, the Ruffian, was trying to navigate into a slip in Egerton Harbor. It seemed to be having some trouble, so it started backing up, where it eventually kind of crashed into this smaller boat, the Payback, as well as damaged a dock and a dinghy. The owner of the Payback is kind of who we focused on here a lot. He's a local fisherman named Donald Benefit. He fishes for conch and takes folks out on charter trips. He does dredging for the town, too. He's kind of a real working guy in Egerton. But he estimated the damage to his boat at 20 or 30 grand, something like that. But I think more importantly, this is kind of his prime time for his business with chartering and fishing. And because his boat has been out for so long, he hasn't been able to make an income. And he believes he's owed something a little shy of $300,000.
I want to paint a visual for people who are listening at home. The Ruffian, this enormous yacht, is big, white, gleaming. You can see the reflections in the side of it. There's a video on the website, as you say, of this incident happening. And then the Payback, this small fishing boat, is kind of blue and does look a little bit scruffy. I think it's from 2000 it was built, but it's obviously seen years at sea. And now the fisherman can't benefit. He can't fish and do conch fishing. So how's it moving forward? Because when they reached out to the owners of the big yacht, they haven't had a lot of satisfaction, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I guess I'll tell a little bit about the owner. We believe it's, you know, technically, I think the boat of this yacht is owned by an LLC, but we do know, we found out that he's kind of the owner of that as the CEO of a medical center in Michigan. And the benefit is his yacht is worth something like $30 million. Mm. If that paints the picture, he's worth something like $100 million is what we've heard. You know, and I think the fisherman is kind of saying, you know, giving him some payback for the damages would be like filling up a tank of gas for his yacht. But I think, as you were saying at the top, I think the story is kind of, you know, Egerton Harbor, it's a busy harbor. You have a lot of fishermen, shell fishermen and charters, but you also have these, you know, big expensive yachts that come through that aren't necessarily used to navigating the area. We did have a quote from a harbor master that it might not have made the final cut, but he said this type of thing does happen, where these big yachts can cause some damage. We haven't necessarily documented all of that, but I think it kind of speaks to this clash of, you know, super yachts and really the working waterfront of Martha's Vineyard.
You can see the video at the website of the Martha's Vineyard Times. That is Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
A Chatham man has embarked on an arduous journey to honor the memory of his wife. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with details. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, this is Marty Cavanaugh, and his wife, Mary, was executive director of the Chamber of Commerce. Tell us what he's doing.
Sure. Well, last September, Mary passed away suddenly, and, you know, it was a blow to the town. She was very popular director of the Chamber of Commerce. And Marty and his two daughters worked to establish a foundation in her name to distribute funds for a scholarship and to other organizations that she cared about in the area. And in order to sort of draw attention to this and to honor the memory of Mary, Marty decided to embark on the what's known as the Great Continental or the Great Divide bike ride. And, you know, I hadn't heard about this before, but it is a 2,700-mile tour, basically, of the country from Canada straight down to the Mexican border. It basically follows the continental divide, and it's through mountains, valleys, plains. It basically hits on every sort of ecosystem that the country has to offer. If you think about how that route would work, You're going through mountains up in the north, and then you get to the sort of plains area and prairies, and then you end up in the desert. So it's a pretty arduous trip. And I spoke with Marty when he stopped in Idaho, and he was telling me about there's most of the ride is off road. I think he said only 5% of the ride is on paved roads. The rest is off road, and it's through wilderness basically. And he said that not only do you have to worry about the bike breaking down, you have to contend with he said that horse flies and mosquitoes were terrible. That he basically was camping most of the way. When the trail went through a town, he could stay in a hotel, but much of it involved camping. Mm. And he said, in that case, you have to worry about things like bears, and cougars and other creatures who inhabit these wilderness areas. So it's not only a physically taxing effort, you have to, be on your guard as well.
And so, as we said at the top, this is kind of a fundraiser for this fund established in Mary Kavanaugh's name. And people can follow along on his ride, Marty Kavanaugh's ride, and also can still contribute to this.
Sure. He's got an Instagram account where he's posting photos of his ride, and that's at mgc.foundation. And the name of the foundation is the Mary Rose G. Kavanaugh Foundation, and folks can contribute to it by visiting the Cape Cod Foundation, where you can search for the Mary G. Kavanaugh Foundation and find ways to contribute. And Marty, he expects to be, he's about halfway through now. He started in June, and this is going to take about 2 months, he said. And he's planning to be back here in Chatham in August for his birthday.
All right. We're sending him good wishes on the road. That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
The very last event of the Biden-Harris presidential campaign took place this past weekend. It happened in, of all places, Provincetown. And shortly after it happened, everything about the national political scene changed. Molly Reinman of the Provincetown Independent has the story and joins us. Hi, Molly.
Hi, thanks for having me. How are you?
Molly, Kamala Harris came to town for a long-scheduled fundraiser on Saturday, and there were a lot of tensions and questions around this, even among Democratic supporters just going into this. Can we say that?
Yeah. So, there was over 1,000 people at the event on Saturday, and all of whom obviously were donors who had to buy tickets to be there. And we found from just talking to attendees that, this was before President Biden announced that he was dropping out of the 2024 presidential race. But every single donor with whom we spoke was very, very skeptical of his ability to beat Trump and very, very strongly thought that he should drop out. So, yeah, it's fair to say tensions were high even among the donor base that was there.
And creating a lot of attention on this one event, that's for sure. Tell us a little bit about when Kamala spoke. She didn't point to any of that at all. It sounds like she was leaning much more into her own messaging.
Yeah, I mean, the New York Times reported that she didn't even know that Biden had only just come to the decision himself on that Saturday, almost a week ago at this point. So I think it's fair to say that Kamala at the event in Provincetown was, she was not leaning too heavily into the Biden-Harris campaign. She was using a lot of vague messaging, saying that we were going to win, but not necessarily specifying who we was. But she certainly wasn't, giving any inkling to the crowd there that, President Biden was going to drop out the next day. And she was, within less than a week going to be the presumptive mm-hmm. Democratic nominee.
There were a number of big political names there. Tell us who was there.
Yeah. So it was a great lineup of young Democrats there to sort of prime the crowd for Vice President Harris. So there was Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey, Sarah McBride, who's the first transgender U.S. state senator and who's currently running for the House from Delaware. They had Ed Markey, Pete Buttigieg, and his husband, Chasten, and, of course, Jennifer Coolidge, the actress from The White Lotus, was there, too, to get the crowd going.
And what kinds of things did this lineup of bigwigs kind of, what did they bring to the crowd? What did they say?
Yeah, I mean, it was in Provincetown, you know, so it's a very gay crowd, and there was a lot of talk about LGBTQ issues, how the Democratic ticket and the Biden-Harris administration the past 4 years has been a champion of LGBTQ issues, but also sort of leaning into the potential perils of a second Trump term and what that would pose for LGBTQ rights. And of course, given that we had a lot of, you know, Massachusetts state politics, state politicians there, there was a lot of discussion of Massachusetts issues and issues that pertain specifically to the Cape, you know, like climate change and its potential effects in Provincetown.
This was, of course, a fundraiser. Do we have an idea how much money was raised?
Yeah, so event host Brian Raffinelli was one of several hosts at the event, but he was the one who introduced Vice President Harris before she spoke. And he told the crowd that the event raised over $2 million. And, you know, a little less than half of that was raised just in the week leading up to the event. And the prior to the event, the team stated that their target goal was $1 million, so they definitely surpassed that.
Did you get a chance to circle back with some of the folks who attended this the day after, as the news came out that Kamala was, or that Biden, I guess, was stepping down, and then by the end of that day, even that she was gathering such momentum to head the ticket?
Yeah, I did. So we actually connected with a group of donors before they entered the event, and then we connected with them the next day after they left the event and also after Biden had withdrawn. And the energy we got from them before the event was that they were skeptical of President Biden and of the Democratic ticket, and they hadn't given a ton of money as, you know, previously devoted Democratic donors to the Biden-Harris ticket. But when we talked to several donors the following day after President Biden had dropped out, they both pledged that they were going to put more work into Vice President Harris's campaign and donate more money than they had.
It must have been just a lot of energy there. Can you just give us a sense of what the whole scene was like?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to the politicians and, you know, Jennifer Coolidge, the actress who was there, there were several, you know, gay celebrities there as well. And, you know, I said it was a crowd of 1,000 next to Pilgrim Monument. It was a beautiful day. Everyone was really amped to be there. And, you know, the lineup that preceded Vice President Harris was just, you know, really engaging with the crowd. There was a lot of laughter. And by the time Kamala took the stage, you know, she was met with roaring applause. It was very lighthearted energy, too, which was, you know, extra unique given the fact that there at the time was so much controversy within the Democratic Party. But yeah, everyone we had a chance to catch up with after was happy to be there, you know, expressed like very much honored to be a part of Provincetown and have the campaign come all the way out to the very edge of the Outer Cape to engage with them.
It's Molly Reinman of the Provincetown Independent, where you can read all about it. And there's some great pictures as well. Molly, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Have a good rest of your day.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Nantucket continues to deal with the fallout from the broken offshore wind turbine blade, which we spoke about earlier. Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current has the latest from the island and joins us now. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
Earlier in the program, we talked about GE ascribing the failure of this blade to a manufacturing problem. I'm curious about the response on the island. Once more, there was a select board meeting on Wednesday where this dominated discussion. And one of the things at issue here is the good neighbor agreement that Vineyard Wind signed with the town, in which the town now says that it may look to renegotiate. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And that was the select board, you know, continuing to hear a lot of concern and anger from island residents about what happened with the turbine and the debris washing up on the beaches. They were also hearing calls to rip up this agreement that the town, along with the two local nonprofits, the Mariah Mitchell Association and the Nantucket Preservation Trust, signed with Vineyard Wind back in 2020. Now, this deal was done in executive session, so the public really wasn't aware until it was final. And it really stipulated that it was done to mitigate some of the impacts to Nantucket's National Historic District designation. And part of what Vineyard Wind agreed to do was to move back the front row of turbines, to paint them a certain color, to blend in with the horizon, and install a aircraft detection lighting system, which would allow the lights to turn off unless there's an airplane in the area. And this was all done in exchange for about $16 million that's going to be distributed amongst the town and those nonprofits, as well as a pledge of support for this project. So it has been controversial. Some people, even before the incident, were calling for the town to scrap it. There was a vote at town meeting where it was narrowly defeated, a vote to back out of the agreement, and that was before the turbine failure. So what the selectmen came out and said on Wednesday was that they are, in fact, going to intend to renegotiate this agreement with Vineyard Wind. Not pull out, but renegotiate the terms. We don't know exactly what that means yet, how it might look or be different. This is all happening in executive session, but it was a big step by the select board to make that announcement, I think, on Wednesday publicly that this agreement was now on the table to be renegotiated.
Are they looking for damages? Is that what this is about? Or for more money? Yeah,
I think that is part of what the discussion is in executive session. What, you know, we can see the agendas and what they go in to discuss. Part of that was, you know, potential litigation against Vineyard Wind to recoup some of the damages that the town has incurred to clean up, to respond to this, what the town has called a crisis. So I think that's all part of what's happening now behind closed doors in executive session.
What is the state of the cleanup on the island now? We know that last week, when this first happened, there was a one day when the Southside beaches were closed entirely. What's it look like on the ground there now?
Yeah, so the large pieces that were very visible and very obvious in the few days, last Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, those have all been cleaned up. Now, what Vineyard Wind said on Wednesday was that, you know, they have the hotline open. People are calling in debris when they find it. Those reports have becoming fewer and fewer. What they're finding now is just sort of regular trash that maybe people called in and mistook for debris. They're cleaning that up anyway. But what local residents, and, you know, we've had a number of people, fishermen, you know, posting videos and sharing them with us about what the small, really sort of minute fragments that they're finding in the surf, along the surf line at high tide. So very small, and that's, you know, obviously of concern, not just walking along the beach, but, you know, there's marine life ingesting these. So that's some of the concerns now that the sort of larger pieces are gone and been hauled away. What's left are these really small fragments of fiberglass and foam.
Now, a company has been hired to do an environmental assessment, at least a preliminary assessment. It's a company that already has a relationship with the town. This is Arcadis?
Yeah, Arcadis is a global environmental and engineering consulting firm. And they were hired by GE Vernova, which is the manufacturer of the turbine, to do an initial environmental assessment. Now, the town released this late Tuesday night. It was a 11-page document, really preliminary, but some of the conclusions it came to was that, you know, sort of the primary danger posed by the debris is sort of physical contact coming into people coming into contact with debris on the beach that is sharp, jagged, sort of physical injuries, and talked about sort of what these things are made of. They did release the material safety data sheets from GE Vernova to, you know, that's a 400-page document talking about what these things are made of. And then, you know, talking about while there's no PFAS used in the manufacturing of these blades, there are certain pieces that are attached to each blade that do contain PFAS or a type of PFAS, which is sort of what you find in Teflon. And what the report really shared was that we still have a lot to learn and a lot to study from this before we draw any sort of major conclusions about the environmental impact of this debris coming onto Nantucket and other places around the region.
It's Jason Grazia of Nantucket Current, where you can find a link to that report as well. Jason, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
State lawmakers are heading into their final week of business before recessing for the rest of the calendar year. Our Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about this and other news from Beacon Hill. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Katie.
Hey, Patrick. Good morning.
Let's start nationally, if we could, Katie. Vice President Kamala Harris has enough support already to become the Democratic nominee for president. Massachusetts DNC delegates voted to endorse her. How quickly did that all come together? I mean, relatively quickly, right? It's been only a few days. And really, how close is the current VP to naming her own running mate?
Yeah, it's been something of a whirlwind these past few days since President Biden announced he wouldn't be seeking re-election. It was, I think, just the next day that Massachusetts, including our DNC delegates here, coalesced behind Harris following the president's endorsement. The Democratic State Committee has also voted to endorse her. So a lot of support in Massachusetts, where, of course, we've seen Kamala Harris fundraising, even when it was still the Biden-Harris ticket. So it's not a huge surprise there. And as far as who will join her on her ticket, it's still up in the air as she evaluates those candidates. Governor Maura Healey this week didn't weigh in on who that pick should be. She, you know, basically says it's up to Harris. There's a lot of talent in her eyes in the Democratic Party, but she has also spoken very highly of Harris. She joined her in Provincetown just last weekend for a fundraiser there and liked what she heard.
Yeah, the last official Biden-Harris sort of event happened right here on Cape Cod. All right, let's talk about Wednesday. That marks the end of this session, July 31st. So there's a push in these final days, Katie, for health reform, including prescription drug costs. Tell us about what the unanimous House vote means for what people can expect to start paying at the pharmacy. Is it going to be any better?
So there's a couple pieces, different ways the House is trying to get at this. One is through regulating pharmacy benefit managers, who are the middlemen, really, between insurance companies, drug makers, and pharmacists. And then there's a cap on costs, patient costs for certain prescription drugs that would treat diabetes, asthma, and heart condition. Under the House bill, insurers would need to offer one generic drug for those conditions free to their members. And for a name brand medication for those three categories, the copays would be capped at $25 for 30 days supply. So that's a big deal. The question here is whether the House and the Senate managed to reach a deal in the next week here, because the Senate has really tried to pass prescription drug legislation since 2019. The House is new to this fight. They said it's taken a while for them to get there because they wanted to make sure they're finding a way to preserve the economic engine that pharmaceutical companies and that broader biotech space provide here in Massachusetts.
I cannot recall them taking such a long break. After July 31st, they're off until, you tell me, January for the most part. Is that right?
Yeah, there'll still be some legislative business. The House and the Senate do have to meet every 72 hours under the state constitution, but this is it for the big stuff. And from here, they pivot to the campaign trail because we do have a primary the day after Labor Day. There's, of course, the state election as well as the presidential election in November. And then there's something of a holiday break. But as big news and policy matters emerge, which they always find a way to do, the state legislature and government at large will continue to respond to them.
And finally, shelters are running out of space, and they have been for some time throughout Massachusetts. Governor Healey now going further with restricting shelter access to migrant families. What are the new limits taking effect next week?
Yeah, this is really the latest shift from Beacon Hill to what has been a 1980s law guaranteeing shelter to eligible homeless families. Starting next week, starting August 1st, families will be prioritized for shelter access based on a number of factors, including whether they have medical conditions, a newborn infant, a veteran, or if they lost their home here in Massachusetts through a no-fault eviction or a natural disaster, something beyond their control. Other families who aren't among those priority groups will be able to stay for just 5 days in what the state had previously been calling overflow or safety net shelters and are now known as temporary respite shelters to underscore the short-term nature. And after that, those families won't be able to get a spot in the full shelter system for 6 months. The governor says this is about sending a message to people who are coming from outside of Massachusetts that there's just no more room here. And that's a message she's been trying to underscore for several months now since last fall, putting a cap on the capacity of the shelter system.
That is Katie Lannon from the State House. Katie, we'll be talking with you a week from now about a recap of the final days of the legislative session. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's CAI's Patrick Flannery speaking to our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. AmeriCorps is a service organization, typically for young people newly out of college. And for a quarter of a century, AmeriCorps workers have been coming to the Cape. Marilee Cassidy, staff photographer of the Cape Cod Times, spent parts of the last 10 months documenting the work of the latest class of AmeriCorps here on the Cape, and she joins us now. Hi, Marilee.
Hello.
Great photos here. This latest class was sworn in September. You were there for that. They received some training, and then they were sent into the field. Give us a sense of some of the places and projects at which these folks were working.
So I met up with them about 20 times, and this project represents a very small fraction of the work that these members have done. This group has put on more than 30,000 service hours on the Cape. They've left their mark in all 15 towns and with various nonprofit organizations, and they've been to what seems like every conservation area on the Cape, trimming and cutting invasive species. They clear herring runs. They help to grow oysters. They put on a water quality education program for young students, and they help save dolphins. They work year-round through all kinds of weather. They work hard. And like you said, they graduated yesterday, and today is their move-out day. And a new group will come in September.
I'm curious, as you went back to spend time with them over the last 10 months again and again in different locations, what impressed you about them?
They do work very hard. It's not easy work, and they have a service schedule. And if it's torrential rain, they're out there. If it's cold weather, they're out there. If it's a hot, sticky summer day, they're out there. They stick to their schedule. They work hard. And it's not easy.
I jotted down some of the places that you took photographs. They were working at Dolphin Stranding off Herring Cove Beach. They were at Peterson Farm in Falmouth. They were doing erosion mitigation at the Cape Cod National Seashore and working with a shellfish constable in Wellfleet. And as you say, in all 15 towns across the Cape, they were invested here in time, putting time and effort into doing projects. Going back again and again to visit them, did you see them change over that time, this group of young people?
I think so. When I first met with them, they were new to the organization. And then towards the end, you could hear the banter of them just because they live together, they work together, they've become forever friends, they've made forever contacts. So I think this program will stick with them for the rest of their lives.
Here we are in July. Was it fun for you to kind of look back over these photos and look at that arc of the 10 months and nearly a year and revisit some of these moments?
It was, and it was exhausting. Just looking at the photos and their hard work, it was exhausting just looking at their hard work. So I give them credit.
That is Marilee Cassidy, who is staff photographer of the Cape Cod Times, and you can see her photo essay at the Cape Cod Times website. Marilee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
That's the news for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. We spoke with CAI's Eve Zuckoff and Sam Houghton at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We heard from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Molly Reinman at the Provincetown Independent, and Jason Grazia of Nantucket Current. CAI's Patrick Flannery checked in with our State House reporter Katie Lannon, and we heard there from Marilee Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. When things speed up behind the scenes here, he's got a steady pulse. We depend on it. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.